The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams. Episodic foresight is identified as the primary neural mechanism that enables humans to construct images of the futures. It provides explanatory power to further define and understand the processes that are invoked in future studies and foresight activities. These enlightening words are from Marie Conway, who joined us today to chat about how humans can imagine and construct images of the futures and what happens in our brain. Mary has extensive experience in foresight in practice, and she's founder of Foresight Futures, a consultancy studio on strategic foresight. Welcome, Mary, and thank you to join me at the briefing today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's a pleasure to have you. So you recently completed your PhD, which focuses on possible futures for the university, which is a very topical topic for the moment with the situation. And there was a part of great value that didn't actually make it into the 70,000 plus words of the thesis, which is already an outstanding achievement, writing 70,000 words plus. So I'm doing myself a PhD, which I know the struggles that we go through, but there's always an award at the end. So it is a stringent battle to choosing what to put in and what, you know, had to stay out. And your interesting one is about exploring the links between neuroscience and foresight. What caught my attention on that is it's quite unique. So how did you merge the two disciplines?
I'll step back a bit. I became interested in it in a roundabout way because I was curious about why people in workshop environments are variable in the degree to which they can actually engage with the foresight process. So some people can engage with a process without any problems, that they're right into it from the beginning and they contribute and they have wonderful ideas. Other people will contribute but find the process quite difficult, or not difficult, but they're just not quite sure how they're supposed to approach it. And others will simply reject it. I had a senior professor in a university tell me once that this process was quite hard and they didn't think they were going to do it. And they didn't in the end. And I thought, well, you know, why does this happen? Why are some people able to imagine possible futures and others just really can't quite grasp that imagination that they need to bring into their thinking? So that led me to a conversation with my supervisor, who then pointed me to Gareth Pridé, who was a Swinburne University graduate as well, who'd done some initial work on this, and he pointed me in the right direction. So as soon as I talked to him, I realised that this could give me the answer. And it did, but it also gave me a whole lot more because I learned about episodic foresight, which is in the same brain structures and processes as episodic memory. So the same processes and structures that we use to remember things, we also use to reconstruct the future, possible futures. So that really excited me because then I thought, well, yes, if there's a neurological structure that we can call foresight, which essentially is what it is, then people can't go, well, I don't believe in this. You can't imagine the future and I'm not going to do it. So there was something else going on in the background then as well. But what I found was that the neurological and the neuroscience research on episodic foresight and memories of the future and mental time travel are really quite extensive. and it's a really exciting literature. As I said in my PhD, that I have no for most of the papers that I've read, I had no idea what they were talking about. But there's enough in there that you can hang on to and understand to realise that this is an area that people who are interested in the future should be exploring. Maureen Raymond did a PhD specifically on neuroscience and foresight. And she was awarded it last year. So I often refer to her thesis as well, because she obviously knows a lot more about it than I do. I'm skating on the surface. I haven't done a deep dive yet. But that's what that chunk was about that I had to take out because of the word limit. Yeah.
And I think this is something that characterizes you, your simplicity of being an expert on something, but not saying that you're an expert, and being free to say that, because there is so much that we can learn, and you know, we might know already a lot, but there is still a lot that we don't know. And when I invited you to the briefing today, you actually said, I'm very happy to talk about that, but I'm not an expert in neuroscience. And that actually was a really powerful comment, because it tells how passionate you are about what you do and what drives you to contribute to knowledge and make an effort to create awareness and merge disciplines. And this is especially important nowadays when innovation, for example, is often time at the intersection of disciplines. So it's not just one, but we need to see disciplines together and merge them and see it from different perspectives. So we need to get used to this learning and learning voyage.
Yeah. And I think the different perspectives is really important. And it's one of the reasons why I developed this futures conversation framework, which we can talk about later if we have time. But the whole, if you don't have enough people in the room who can develop different perspectives at different levels of understanding, then the futures you produce are going to be quite shallow and superficial. So when we're talking about innovation, then there's parts of the brain that manage the creative process when the brain works, and the left hand and the right hand side of the brains are working with each other, then it's actually really interesting, because you can, the degree of creativity and therefore for me innovation and coming up with new and novel ideas in the present is somewhat constrained by the number of synapses you have in your brain between this creative part of your brain and the other parts, the episodic foresight and the executive network in the brain. So the executive network, I think, if I remember correctly, is the part that decides whether information is not relevant or whether it will put it into long-term memory. So, and if you have more synapses, then you have a better chance of it going into long-term memory over time. But of course, the more you do this kind of work, futures work, the more you can accept it, and the more creative you can become. At least that's the way I read it. But I think that that the need for perspectives, more perspectives than we usually have in organisations, is one of the fundamental principles of this work. And everyone writes about that and talks about it, but doing it in practice is actually quite hard when you're working with particular organisations.
So where that foresight sit, you say it stays on the left side of our brain or on the right side or in the middle?
What was really interesting was that I read some research that said that if in fact, you know, dividing the brain into left and right hand sides is really unhelpful, because they actually work together all the time. But I guess it's just that, I don't know, that some structures are on the right-hand side and some structures are on the left-hand side. So, you know, the brain has different processes going on, but actually they're intersecting all the time, which was really interesting. So, you know, people like me who hate numbers can't, I like words, hate numbers, can't, you know, say, oh, you know, it's just that right, you know, the right, whatever side of the brain it is that, that makes me that way. And it's not true. It's just a preference. But I think the thing about this little exploration I did into neuroscience was that it helped me understand why people, as I said earlier, some people can imagine the future because they recognize this process, this foresight process that's going on, and they start every time they do a foresight process, that those structures in your brain get stronger. And so that whole need for us to imagine the future, because that's the only way that we can know the future in the present, is inextricably tied up with our brain functions. And I think that's really important, because then people can't just dismiss thinking about the future as, you know, crystal ball gazing or fanciful or fairyland, as a lot of people have said. It's actually something that we, you know, we have the neurological capacity to do, and it gets stronger as we use it.
Yeah. And we can train it, like everything. More we do, more we get, better.
We can train that. Absolutely.
You mentioned the future conversation framework.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that.
That's the PhD was about different perspectives, contested perspectives about the university's possible futures. So I was trying to work out how you could actually bring the people who were writing the literature that I was reviewing, what would happen if you could actually bring them together in a context where they could accept that all the perspectives in the room were equally valid for the purpose of considering the future of the university. And so that led me to use integral futures to create this framework, which has four types of conversations. The first one is a conversation with self. So that's one that you have with yourself about your own approach to the future and your own thinking about the future, and trying to recognise where your biases are, what your assumptions are, where your stumbling blocks are, where you go, no, I'm not going to do that, you know, and question. So it's that critical reflection conversation where you're questioning what you believe and why you believe it. And for me, that's the most critical one that we don't often do. And people in foresight processes in organisations generally don't do that kind of questioning before a process or during a process. But I came to believe that this is the most fundamental conversation, and any foresight process that doesn't spend some time in helping people to have that sort of personal conversation aren't going to achieve the best outcomes that they can. So that's one quadrant. The other quadrant is about cultures, which is culture, which is the same sort of thing. You know, we live culture and we reflect culture in organisations, but we don't often sit down and analyse it and map it and say, you know, are these the values that we need to take forward? Why do we do this? You know, the sayings, you know, that this is the way we've always done it, or these are the rules of the game in this organisation. They're constructs. They're not rules. You know, we made them. We can change them. So that's the other conversation. Then the third one is about change. So the organisation exists in a social environment, and so you need to have a conversation about change that generates a longer-term perspective for the organisation, moves them beyond the status quo in the short term, and helps to reorient the organisation to the future. And the final conversation is in the organisation, when people come together to have these conversations about possible futures, which is where you imagine the possible futures and decide what you want to do with them in an organisational sense. So that conversation is about finding pathways into the future, finding options for you. So it's very, this is the space where, you know, scenario planning, for example, would fit, participatory futures, all those kind of processes that engage people in thinking about the future. And a lot of futures work I did when I first started were only concerned with conversations about change and the process that you were using in the organisation. So it's the other side of the integral four quadrants, the tacit sides, the invisible sides, that we also need to bring into our conversations. So I developed this framework, and I'm trying now to make it practical, because the PhD was conceptual. So now I'm trying to, well, how would I put this into practice? So that's my challenge at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating, yeah. And all those four quadrants are going to lead towards that images of the future. So now we can understand the future. I mean, I hypothesize possible futures now to take decision and action in the present.
Yeah, it has to be. Talking about futures is fun. It's, you know, most people will have a good time doing it and enjoy it. But at the end, if you can't actually use it, if it doesn't change something up here for you individually, if the culture of the organisation doesn't become more futures aware, and if the processes that people use in organisations aren't inclusive and as diverse as possible, then, you know, you can have a great process, but the outcomes can be less than useful.
And in your experience, what are the challenges you see of people not approaching foresight or using futures? You know, also, you mentioned earlier on that it was interesting the connection between neuroscience and foresight, and you had experienced people that say, no, we don't want to do that because maybe it's too difficult. So what are some of the challenges of, you know, of those organizations that are not actually, let's say, exploring futures?
There's always organizations that won't engage with you know, deep thinking, deeper and more expansive thinking about the future, because they're not ready for it. I used to say that you could, when you're talking to somebody about, you know, working with them about futures, that you could work out whether you wanted to work with them or not by their eyes. You could watch their eyes, and their eyes would glaze over when you started talking about imagining the future or images of the future or how this kind of thinking can generate new options, new strategic options for you. Some people, particularly data science-based people, and this is a huge generalization, but you know, they need proof. They need proof. I'm always asked for case studies. And when an organisation asks for a case study, I realise that they don't want to think. They just want to be given something that says, this is what somebody else did and this is how they did it, and we'll do that and it'll be okay. So you have to be ready to spend time and energy and resources, both money and people and time and effort, to put into this process. And when I first started, it was quite difficult to find organisations who were willing to do this on a continuing basis. Most people just wanted, you know, a one-day workshop or a three-day workshop, and that was it. They knew about the future and everything was fine. So I think the biggest challenge is finding a way to work with people so that they're happy to have a go. So, you know, that they're not certain about this process and what it will generate. There are no, you know, definitive case studies. but they're happy to have a go because it sounds really interesting and sounds like it could be useful. So they're willing to see what happens.
Yeah. Case studies are always the silver bullet to help companies understand the process and possible end results. The key is making people comfortable with the uncomfortability generated by uncertainties and ambiguities of the situation. However, case studies are not always a thing in future studies because when we're looking into 20, 30, 50 years from now, there is quite a delay between the exercise and possible results. So it is another extra challenge of showing the benefit and the power of future studies. On your paper, you mentioned, and this is actually the title of this conversation, episodic foresight, and you merge those two words, episodic and foresight, offering four levels to generate and to kind of stimulate those episodic foresight.
I think the first one is to recognize that the brain lets us imagine the future, that we do it every day subconsciously, but what we try to do is make that a conscious process. I think the brain, I mean, I can't tell you exactly what parts of the brain are used, but the trigger is around looking for things that are new and novel in the present. So you're seeking out not more of the same. You're deliberately looking for new interpretations and new perspectives and new understandings of issues or events or processes. So it's a constant process of challenge. So you have to recognize you have this process and then you have to start challenging what you see. Because I can't remember who said that what you see isn't necessarily what there is, that seeing isn't always. You look at something, look at an organisation and you look at the structure and you think that's all there is, but in fact there's lots of layers beneath the organisational structure. So we need to be able to stop and say, oh, is that real? So there's that thing about recognising we have foresight, being able to challenge the way you think, and then also being able to work with others who have also recognised this foresight capacity. Because I equated episodic foresight because of the terminology. I mean, that's a neurological term, episodic foresight. And so it immediately you think, well, this is what we talk about when we talk about foresight as a cognitive capacity. So it's that process of saying, okay, our brains let us do this, and designing a process that triggers our ability to imagine possible futures. Now, I don't know the detail of that, of how the brain actually does that. All I know is that it does it. And so then it becomes a process, as I said, of helping people to challenge assumptions, challenge their thinking, and looking for the new perspective, the new understanding. I mean, Pierre Weck, when he was talking about scenarios, said that the most important thing was for us to be able to re-perceive the present. And I think that holds true today as well. So the levers are really in here, in our minds, and then in our ability to question ourselves and in our ability to then work collectively as well in organisations to change what happens in the organisation as well.
And you mentioned Sanders, you quote Sanders in your article, and I found that really almost a romantic in name, you know, in an Italian sense, you know, and you say, I mean, Sanders says, imagination is the only tool which take us from simple reason analysis to higher synthesis. While imagination is intangible, it creates and shapes our reality. While a mental tool, It affects our behavior and expectations. The kind of future we imagine would depend on the quality of our imagination. That says a lot. There is a lot in those words. And he really stressed on the attention to details, looking at different, and the ability to tell shared intangible mental process.
Yeah, I think that's, I agree. It's a lovely quote. When I was doing my PhD and I found that, I got very excited. I thought that explains it perfectly. I think it's we have to recognize, I think, that imagination is as valid a source of data as statistics or forecasts or things that rely on numerical data. I think if we can, it's the integral futures thing, that there's a world in here and there's a world out there, and they're both important, they're both critical. So that's why imagination is so critical. But I think one of the challenges we face, thinking back to your last question, one of the challenges we face is getting getting people to accept that imagination is a valid source of data in a world that's changing so rapidly as it is now, and where previous ways of sense-making don't make any sense anymore. So we need to just sit down and think of something new and let ourselves, not holding ourselves back, letting ourselves actually enjoy imagining for once, because we don't often get the opportunity to do that in organisations today, is to sit down and imagine what's possible.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. Imagination is something hard to give metrics to. You know, it's hard to quantify. You know, it's hard to have KPIs. You know, if we want to talk about from a business perspective, you know, tell me a KPI for imagination. Yeah, it's almost impossible to think about that. But at the same time, that's inherent ingredients of innovation. You know, we can imagine that something is different. We can imagine something new, and then we try to understand how to arrive to that.
Yeah, I think innovation is all about imagination, but it's been a bit like strategic planning. It's been formularized and measured because people want proof and they want return on their KPI and they want to see outcomes and all that kind of thing. And this process of imagining possible futures and building the capacity to do that in an organisation takes time, because it has to change. The individual has to recognise this capacity and the value of imagination, and then continue to do that over time, and collectively then in an organisation over time it builds to be an organisational capacity. So in the business world at the moment, where everything is so, you know, people want answers, and they want outcomes, and they want proof that what they're doing is the right thing to do. Things that take a long time are generally dismissed as, you know, not possible or not useful in this context. But I think too that more and more people coming to realize that process, that measured, audited, you know, performance-based process, is failing. Mm-hmm. It might have worked a decade ago, but it's failing. And there's something new. There's something new emerging at the moment, you know, with different types of organizational structures and different projects that are going on. But we have to value imagination, and we have to value the time we spend imagining. And we have to value the process of building the capacity to imagine in organisations more than we do now.
So far, we discussed about a different aspect of innovation foresight and how our brain function and works when we're thinking and hypothesizing and imaging about the futures. But there is still a lot to be done in the field of neuroscience and foresight, and you bring those two together, maybe for the first time, or, you know, being one of the first that tried to really understand what are the neurological aspects of thinking and imagining about the futures. What are for you, you know, future consequences and future contribution that can be brought to the field to, you know, to contribute to knowledge if we are moving forward with this type of research?
Yeah, I think that perhaps one thing that would emerge would be proof for people or a wider understanding across a greater number of people about how this innate capacity we have to imagine the future actually happens and why it's valuable. I think the neuroscience side of it completely negates the thing that happens in workshops when people say, oh, I can't do this. I can't project out. I have to stay in the present. And when you ask them to move into a future space, they say, well, I can't do that. I can't do that. But in fact, they can. But it's what you said. We have to train ourselves to do it. I know Maureen Raymond's thesis, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, goes into this a little bit more. She does a great deal of analysis on how the areas come together. So I think her thesis would be a good place for people to start. But for me, it's that understanding that our brains allow us to imagine the future. And if we train our brains, they'll get stronger at doing that. And we can actually open up our minds to possible futures and accept futures that we previously would have said, well, that's ridiculous, that's rubbish, that will never happen. That we can actually say, well, hang on a minute, let's explore that a bit further. And I think that's the outcome that you want. You want people being willing to explore rather than rejecting because their brain is still stuck or trapped in old ways of thinking.
Yes, yeah, so there would be more in this space. There would be much more. And I think, as you said, continuing the research on neuroscience and foresight, that might give measurement to imagination to some extent.
Oh, yes.
So that could, the imagination is something really important.
And I just remembered as you were talking then that the Turku University, the Finland Futures Research Centre, have a futures consciousness test that it's not open to the public, but people can get access to it if they're using it for research, which actually helps people understand the different capacities that are involved in thinking about the future. So the openness to experience is one. There's a temporal perspective, and there's five altogether, and I can't remember them off the top of my head, but that's a really, when I first found that, I got excited as well, because I thought, well, you know, this is how we can do it. You know, when you're structuring foresight processes, you can make sure that these five areas are, you know, in the process somewhere so that you can trigger them in people. And some people will get it straight away and other people will take time. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much, Mary. So before we go, what's the last book you read or the one you're currently reading?
I'm currently reading a... this is a bit embarrassing. No, it's not. I quite enjoy it. Let me just get the title of it. I'm currently reading a crime fiction book.
Ooh.
which is how I relax.
Yeah, sometimes we need to change the topic of our reading, because otherwise if we read only what is related to our work, you know, it's just going to be boring to some extent.
The latest book I found based on my work is one by Marcus Fussy and somebody else. It's I only just found it today in a book called Duo Ethnography, which looks amazing, looks really amazing. So I'm going to read that. But at the moment, I'm reading a book by Peter May, who's a UK-based author called The Night Gate, and it's all about Paris, which is really nice. But, yeah, death in Paris. Yeah, but it helps me escape.
And we need that for our imagination.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mary, for being with me today.
Thank you again for the invitation. I'm not sure I answered all the questions as clearly as possible, but this is an area that I'm still learning as well. So
it's I think the field is quite new, as in the combination of neuroscience and foresight. And there is a lot to discover and explore. And I mean, you said a lot of very interesting things that people can just grab one and deep dive into that and, you know, open a Pandora box. So I'm sure there is a lot of knowledge there.
Thank you. No, it was fun. Thank you.
The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams.